You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Giro d'Italia. Today we are at the Tre Cime di Lavaredo.
Luckily I had the legs to respond to Primoz when he went, and then it was a bit of cat and mouse. I went 400 to go, and after about 100 metres I realised that's a long way at altitude. But yeah, and then just tried to press onto the line, and so yeah, a decent day.
Yeah, Roglic slipped 3 seconds at the end. Is that a worry, and do you think that's got to do with his bike change?
I wouldn't say it's a worry, but you know, he came past me and I was just sort of like, whoa, kind of almost thought I was at the line, but when it's that steep you've got to keep pushing, and I was like, oh blimey, still need to get there. But the bike change and stuff, yeah, I think the, you know, their bike's on the weight limit and ours is pretty close as well, so. But yeah, it's just all down to tomorrow now.
Yeah, tomorrow, anything, what are you going to do? Your bike changed. What's the second bike going to be?
Well, it's just, you know, we'll start on the TT bike, jump onto the road bike, and then like we have, same one I've been riding here. And yeah, it'll just be 5K at like 15% or something crazy. So just try and pace it all the way to the line. It's a decent advantage, you know, I'd rather have that than have the deficit, but it's going to be super hard. You know, Primoz is riding really well, Almeida is great at pacing himself, so it's certainly not over. I'm just going to have to get up there as quickly as I can. It's a bit of an unknown because it's, you know, we hardly ever do a mountain time trial, so it's definitely different, but it's the same for everyone, and we'll see how we go.
It was fun, and tomorrow we go full again, huh? Thank you. Yeah. It's good, got a bit legs back, so tomorrow we go full,
Confident for the time trial tomorrow?
I mean, if I wouldn't be confident, then I don't start, so of course, the best one at the end beats.
Well, buonasera, buonasera.
Buonasera, Daniel.
Il barone, what we heard there. What we heard first was Geraint Thomas and Primoz Roglic beautifully setting up tomorrow's big showdown on the Monte Rosari. And what we heard after that was some new friends we've made. And we're sitting just, well, on the shore of Lago di Misurina, just at the bottom of the Tre Cime di Lavaredo climb, and we've got some Czech cyclo tourists.
They're from the unchecked republic.
Yeah, and they look as though they're drinking in fairly unchecked fashion as well. They've got I think they're on their second or third bottle of Prosecco. Yeah, and they understood that, didn't they? They understood
that.
Cheers, guys. We're not translating that. Brian.
Well, yes, Daniel.
I'd said that. We heard from Geraint Thomas and Primoz Roglic ahead of tomorrow's fantastic, we think it's going to be a fantastic showdown tomorrow on the Monte Rosari, and well, didn't today just set it up perfectly, because
exactly.
We saw a fantastic finale in a fantastic, extraordinary, grandiose setting, and we're in a grandiose setting now, because I mentioned Lago di Misurina. We're also looking, if we
it's
look
right behind
to
you.
Yes, if we look to my left, your right, Brian, we see the group of the Sorapis, one of the most famous mountain massifs in the Dolomites. The toponym does come from piss, urinating. I've checked this. But it's one of the most one of the most distinctive shaped mountain massifs. Can you describe it, Brian? I set you this very difficult task yesterday with the Pelmo.
Bear
in mind, the English isn't your first language.
The interesting thing about this one is that it sort of has a plateau if you look at its horizontal lines, but there's all kind of, and it looks like because the depth of vision here is quite clear today, it looks like 20 mountains just like stacked next to each other, and this snow, just the emphasis of all the shadows, the snow, glimpses of clouds, little bit of scattered sunshine reflecting in the snow. It is the most spectacular place in any mountain scenario for bike riding. The Dolomites are just absolutely incredible.
Dino Buzzato could not have said it better
himself.
I'm
pretty sure he could.
I'm sure he couldn't, Brian. I'm sure he couldn't. But what a day we've had. Well, stage winner, we haven't mentioned him yet, Santiago Buitrago. But he was only one half of the story today, wasn't he? Well, there were many stories. There were many threads that we will pull on tonight. And Brian, I propose that we start, we get our teeth into this episode very early on. And we hear from one of the protagonists, one of the undoubted protagonists of today's stage. I think you probably have guessed who I'm talking about. It's a very familiar voice on the cycling podcast.
Well, then if my voice is not very clear right now, it's because I was screaming at him when he was riding right past where I was standing. I felt like I was like on the roadside cheering on our Larry.
I'm unwittingly posing for a photo with our Czech fans. Yes, helmet. Larry Walbass, the Motown maestro, lucky Larry, âgé de Zer Citroën. He's been sending his postcards from Italy throughout this Giro d'Italia. And Brian, let's preface the tale of the tapa, as we sometimes do, with today's installment of La Ranzana. Very relevant to what occurred later. We talk about breakaways, how to get into breakaways, how Larry hoped to get into one today. Here's today's L'Aranzando.
L'Aranzando, a postcard from Italy with Larry Warbass.
Larry, last swing of the bat today. How do you try and psych yourself up when you know that the breakaway's your goal, isn't it? Have you been watching David Goggins' videos on the bus this morning? How do you, giving yourself a pep talk, how do you psych yourself up? Watching Coach Taylor videos from Friday Night Lights? That's what I do.
No, the only thing I've been watching this Giro is Ted Lasso, so I just started the latest season, which is obviously a great series. I wasn't doing anything particularly to psych myself up, which maybe is a problem. I don't know.
You're looking too zen to me, Larry, this morning. Get in that bus and start slapping yourself in the face. I don't know, put your head in a basin of cold water. What are the prospects of the break today? I think a lot of people are quite pessimistic because so much of the stage is climbing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really hard to know. You know, it's like if you have good legs in the break, then anything's possible. But, I mean, we'll definitely see a big battle in the GC group, whether that's also for the stage win or just for the general at the end. You know, I mean, I guess some people think maybe the guys aren't going to go too crazy because the TT is so hard tomorrow. But, I mean, if I was going for the GC and fighting for the podium, I'm sure I would still be trying today. So we'll see. The thing is like you could see a lot of the big teams were tired yesterday, you know, aside from Sepp Kuss, and then I mean the Ineos guys are super strong, but they still only have a couple guys who are really there in the mountains. So yeah, I mean, you never know, it could be just one by one total war at the end. So you know, the thing is everyone's going to be trying for the break. It's like 60K flat, and it's the last day.
Flat-ish. It's kind of
good. Yeah, 1% or something like that. Yeah, I mean, it's up valley, right? But I'm expecting a battle.
The modus operandi of getting into a break, as yours pretty much remained constant over the years? Have you always had one strategy that you've stuck to, or is it something that you chop and change? Like, even in the course of the same three-week tour, you think, I tried yesterday being in this part of the peloton, tomorrow I'm going to try that part of the peloton, or...
Yeah, it's something that I've changed a lot, you know. It's like, I remember 2 years ago I said, okay, every time I'm just going to follow the first attack of the day, because, like, there's always one or two that'll go the first attack of the day. And then that didn't work for me for, like, you know, half of the race. And I said, okay, today that's really stupid. You know, I'm not going to do that. And then the first one went, you know. So it's always something that you're changing, it's kind of funny. For a while, I tried to get really analytical about it, you know. I was like, okay, it's a small road here. They're going to block there, whatever. But then once, like, Velovure came out, and I wasn't the only one looking on Google Maps and, like, finding all the little pinch points and stuff, now everyone is expecting at, you know, 37K when we hit the small road, they're going to block, you know. So it's like everyone's ready, and then the problem is then it doesn't block because everyone's trying there too. So it's changed a bit over the years. Because now everyone has all the same information, whereas now before you had to look harder. Yeah.
Now you need a mystic or a fortune teller.
So now I try to be, you know, a little bit more feely about it. You know, I try to just sit up there at the front and watch what's happening.
Just wait for the muse.
Yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, I haven't exactly been the world's greatest breakaway goer this Giro, but at the same time, it, you know, takes some really, really good legs like yesterday. Yeah, I mean, I was watching, but then once you get to the climb, if you aren't among the probably 20 best climbers, you're not going to be in it. So today I think there's a chance. If you're not a god, it's still possible. So the human Larry Warbass will be looking for it, that's for sure. But
see you out there, Larry.
Well, Brian, I thought that was absolutely fascinating. I know that Larry, he's a very diligent, he's an assiduous student of bike racing, physiology, training, preparing for stages. And, well, we heard him there talk about how VeloViewer and access to that kind of thing, VeloViewer, we talk about a lot on the podcast, it's sort of eroded part of his natural advantage. But, well, didn't stop him today, did nothing was going to stop Larry, not well Santiago Buitrago and a few others, but
other than that,
but Larry was a man on a mission. Brian, let's hear about that mission in the Tale of the Tapper. Take it away, Brian.
It's time for the Tale of the Tapper.
Thank you, Daniel. So stage 19 from Longarone to Tre Cime di Lavaredo, 183 kilometers. Attacks from the gun, and importantly, one of those who slung his guns today was Motown maestro Larry Warbasser. Group of 12 went away, a few riders joined, Ben Healy tried, Pinot tried, and but the Peloton computer said no. 14 riders got away. I think quite a mixed bag of various types of bike riders, including Rojas, who's like an all-rounder, Carlos Verona, who's a climber, Magnus Cort, who's all kinds of types of bike riders in one. Either way, they went up the road, they got a significant gap, and as they were sort of taking care of those mountain points that Pinot wasn't able to get today, Derek G was one of the riders vacuuming up whatever points of... So we were all thinking there would be a great showdown on the Passo Giao. There wasn't really. The first sort of explosion in the breakaway happened on the Tre Croci, and it was actually also there when the rain started. Someone is putting a beer on my table. Sorry, Daniel. Anyways, so Warbasser tried and he got a gap with 17 kilometers to go, 29 seconds. And it's actually the same instant that Roglic changed bikes down in the main group. Cort and Buitrago bridged up, and unfortunately the Warbass got dropped on the Tre Croci. Away went Santiago Buitrago, Magnus Cort, and Derek G.
Can I just say, can I just describe what Larry tried to do to Derek G?
Yes.
He just hit the east side of the Dolomiti on a mission trying to drop Mr. Derek G.
Ah, I love that. I love that. If we didn't have to pay like copyrights to play the song, that would be the time. So, here's the situation on Tre Croci. The gap was 4 minutes to the breakaway. Thomas had Aaron's manager Plus, Roglic had Kus, Dennis, and Almeida was down to just McNulty to help him out. The big group was, the main group was quite big as they passed Lake Misurina where we're sitting now. In front, Derek G alone, Buitrago 7 seconds behind, and then Santiago Buitrago, Da Drago, went and caught Derek G and blew away as a little leaf in the wind to take the stage win.
I had all my bird references ready for a Derek G victory. The birds that are native to some of the fauna that's native to the Tre Cime di Lavaredo that's common up there. And most of them, unfortunately, I don't know how to pronounce. They're ravens, golden eagles, hibriscan, rock ptarmigan. Sorry to all ornithologists and to Derek G for that appalling attempt.
Anyways, back in the main group, Dunbar was struggling and Almeida took the front. Then Roglic attacked, Thomas went on his wheel, Almeida got dropped. He clawed his way back, and the big three were alone on the last kilometer. Any last kilometer you think, well, that's just going to end like that, not on Tre Cime di Lavaredo. With 400 meters to go, Thomas went, Almeida started to suffer, Roglic came back, and he did a minuscule Roglificacino, and he took...
Roglificazione.
He took 1 second for each of the cime up there, so 3 seconds he clawed back from Thomas in the GC.
He was foiled by Magnus Cort, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. I think Geraint Thomas, he owes Magnus Cort either like some shaving cream or a case of beer. So that was the situation. So all very sort of dramatic until the end. And they definitely kept the tension in the race. They kept the race wide open for tomorrow. And very much looking forward to it, Daniel.
Well, Brian, there was some other movement on the general classification, some significant movement as well, because João Almeida was struggling slightly, wasn't he, on after particularly those Roglic salvos and that Geraint Thomas attack, and he conceded a significant amount of time, an amount of time which will lead us to question whether he's still in the race to win this Giro d'Italia. He's now 59 seconds down on Geraint Thomas tonight. Eddie Dunbar, unfortunately, lost even more time. He started losing ground, well, further down the mountain, and he ended up finishing 13th, 3 minutes and 3 seconds behind Santiago Buitrago. And Dunbar now loses a place on general classification. He drops below Damiano Caruso. Dunbar is now 4 minutes and 53 seconds behind Thomas, and Caruso is 4 minutes 11 seconds. Thibaut Pinot has gained a place on general classification. He's now 5 minutes 10 seconds behind. So he's got a chance tomorrow of leapfrogging Dunbar, you would think. And Timon Arensman is also, well, he moved up 2 places there. He did a fantastic ride. He kept bouncing back.
Yeah, he came back very strongly on the last deeper parts of Trecime. But in general, I mean, the pull that Lance de Plus did for Geraint Thomas, MVP.
Yes. Not for the first time, actually, in this Giro d'Italia. So, Brian, that's the general classification dealt with. Of course, we're going to talk a lot more about that ahead of tomorrow's big sort out, big clash of the titans, battle for, fight for pink, as RCS always like to talk about at the Giro d'Italia.
Fight it was.
But let's focus first on that marvellous effort from our beloved Lucky Larry Warbass, the Motown maestro. Of course, I spoke to him after the finish briefly, but particularly when you hear me refer here to the Hail Mary in Cortina, that was the final attack. That was the moment, probably, Brian, when you were losing your voice in the press room, screaming at...
Outside the press room, on the road, if I may add.
Oh, really? Oh, of course. Here is Larry, a very delighted Larry. Larry's always smiling, but he was delighted to have had this day out today. Of course, he would have liked to win the stage, but it wasn't to be. It will be Larry's day, I'm sure, at a Grand Tour very soon.
That crushed me.
Yeah, I was going to say, you spent a lot of energy in the first hour, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, in the end, we got out there and I said, well, now we just have to stay, do the bit max. And then I knew I had good legs this whole Giro, but I never really got a chance to show myself. So today I wanted to do my best. But yeah, I mean, in the end, there were guys stronger. And I think that first hour took a lot out of me. But yeah, I'm glad I at least got a good day out. I did my best. And I'll come back to the Vuelta and win a stage there.
Tell me about the Hail Mary in Cortina. I guess you tried everything and then you thought, well, why not? Why not try and anticipate?
I knew the thing was I was like already hurting on the last climb, and I knew just for my head, like for my motivation, if I got out front, I would be way stronger. So I just I saw I had a gap, I hit him, and then I rode my tempo, and I think that really helped me get over that climb in the group. And then it was just like getting drop, coming back. But yeah, I mean, I'm proud of my race today. I don't think I could have done anything more.
We're proud of you. What a man.
Thanks.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2023 Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for supporting the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia once again. They've in fact supported us continuously since May 2016, and we're very grateful to them for their support. They've kept us on the road, and while on the road, Daniel and Brian have no doubt been referring to Il Garibaldi, the road book, which gives them all the information they need to cover the race and make their way around Italy. The riders get a copy as well. And I asked Pavel Sivakov of the Ineos Grenadiers if any of the stages stood out.
To be fair, I take day by day. I'm not looking too far ahead. I just know that the last week is going to be basically super, super hard. It's looking at the stages there, thinking we have like the second week we have one 5,000 meter over 5,000 meters of climbing day, and then in the last week we have 2 days. So yeah, basically these days are going to be the most important for JC, for everyone. But now there's one stage, not fearful, but one stage that actually looks crazy for me is that last TT. That looks, is for me, even like these 5,000 meter stages don't look as crazy as that. It's just, second last day, and that's super hard climb. If I would be like a sprinter, I would be scared of that, because I don't know what the time limits are going to be there, but if they make it quite tight, then it's going to be for some guys quite complicated to go in a time limit with that last climb.
Ineos Grenadiers are supported by Science in Sport 2. If you would like to get your hand on the Beta Fuel Gel, designed to improve or maintain peak cognitive performance for when the demands are at their most physical, go to scienceinsport.com.
Now, I was climbing well even before the Giro, but I just got sick. It just cut me that second week, really, you know.
Well, Brian, that was a pretty chipper looking and sounding Mark Cavendish when he crossed the line on the Tre Cime di Lavaredo. He came in safely in 108th place, in fact, 41 minutes down. There were 20-odd riders who finished later than him. Alberto Dainese was the last rider to finish.
He had two teammates with him there, didn't he? Moscon and Scaloni.
Yes. You heard him there talking about how he'd been ill throughout the second week, and prior to that, had felt as though he was climbing very well. But any fears about Mark Cavendish not making it to Rome appear to be misplaced at this point. Jonathan,
great testimony to his shape, really.
Yes, I would agree with that. Jonathan Milan came in another 3 minutes, or 2 minutes further back. But Brian, I should also just mention, did you mention Hugh Carthy not starting?
No, but I can actually see that now.
Yeah, he has been sick over the last few days, which, you know, was... You would not necessarily have noticed from the way he's been riding. He had been maintaining his position on general classification. But Brian, let's talk about the battle for the stage victory and Santiago Buitrago, who he snuck up on Derek G, he snuck up on Larry. There was something inevitable about Buitrago winning this stage, not least because he'd had a quiet race. He was a guy who, at the start of this race, he'd won a stage last year at the similar point in last year's race in the final week. I thought that he would go very well this year, and he's been quiet. He's been doing a lot of work for Damiano Caruso, admittedly.
Do you want to know what also played a big factor today? Gravity. Santiago Buitrago is 59 kilos. He is as pure, I mean, only a real climber or a GC candidate could win here. And he's as much of a pure climber as you can possibly be. You know, lives in Bogota, was born in Bogota, lives in Colombia. He's 59 kilos. He's really like a classic Colombian super climber.
Yeah, and he's got that classic Colombian low cadence as well. Very still on the bike. There was a real contrast between his style and Derek G's style.
Derek probably didn't even hear him.
Yes.
Like, who was that?
And
there were all kinds of fans running next to Riders. Maybe you thought it was a child coming up from behind trying to cheer at him for the win.
That group, it did contain a few sort of class climbers, particularly Carlos Verona, I thought might be a threat at one point, but Buitrago was the one who you always felt would pose the biggest threat. And Derek G, I mean, he's obviously got sensational legs. Didn't talk to him. I didn't manage to at the finish today. I don't think anyone talked to him, because he finally today, this was his fourth second place, and finally he looked really disappointed today, because you know, on the three previous occasions, as we've heard on the podcast, he's been wide-eyed and reveling in every moment of this Giro d'Italia. At least that's what it's looked like. Whereas today, I think finally the cumulative frustration of the second place is kicked in, and gravity has been his only enemy, hasn't it? Particularly, there are three mountain stages where he's come pretty close, and that is, again, a testimony to how well he has been riding.
Certainly, so not to take anything away from Buitrago's win, because that was extremely well-deserved. Massive, massive win for him. I think a lot of cycling fans, as a journalist, you're trying not to be one, but it's hard not to feel very, not sorry because this is a professional sport, but Derek G deserves to win a huge bike race after what he, I mean, he's just been the breakthrough of the Giro, really.
It's going to be fascinating to see what he goes on to do, because he's a rider with an unusual trajectory and an unusual career path up to this point. I was reading a bit about him earlier today. He's a very clever chap. He was on the Dean's List at Queen's University in Canada, which what tells you how smart he is.
Were you on the Dean's List too?
I was, actually.
What does that actually mean?
It means you're sort of top tier. You're top of the class. Not the number one in your year, but you're in the top echelon. You know, I don't know. You as well.
I was okay, number one. Of us. No, I'm just kidding. But can I just interject a notion at this point?
Life sciences he studied, by the way. Sorry, go on.
Well, there's a good future in that, but I think you'll probably stay professional cycling for a while. Speaking of gravity, can I just say that on the biggest mountain stage of the Giro, Magnus Kort was third?
Yes.
And how's that all about?
Yes, and he also might have played a very key role in the destiny
of this Giro
d'Italia.
He could potentially decide the podium of the Giro d'Italia.
Yes, we'll hear a bit more about that later. But yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see what Derek G does next, because he's a pursuer, and we've seen that he can climb. Okay, he was beaten by a more natural climber today, but who knows? There might be sort of 1 week stage races, the general classification in 1 week stage races on his horizon. What about the incident with the AG2R team car? I didn't ask Larry about this. Was it the AG2R team car?
Yeah,
was,
I only saw it on social
I think
media.
They were kicked out.
Yeah, there was a well, they don't come back. There's levels of sanctions, right? You can basically be pulled out of the race for a day, or you can be pulled out for the remainder of the race.
I found myself wondering what, I should have asked Larry this, what had happened as regards feeding, and because presumably, well, there were two AG2R riders in that front group.
Yeah.
Does that mean that he was without a team car in the last...
If that team car was pulled aside and were told, like, basically you're out of the race, he would have been without. On the other hand, I'm quite sure that having been in the breakaway for so long, basically since the start of the stage, I think other team cars would have helped him in case he needed something.
And this was for a collision with Carlos Verona.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
It did put Carlos Verona on the deck, because I saw Carlos Verona's shorts were ripped.
It did, yeah.
Brian, we're going to have to get on to the general classification.
Good for them that Verona is such a gentleman, by the way.
Yes. They couldn't have picked a more gentlemanly rider to do that to. Brian, we're going to have to get onto the general classification in just a minute. Before we do, let's have a bit of a pause here. In fact, let's have a pausa cappuccino.
It's past 11, time for my cappuccino break.
La pausa cappuccino con Lionel Burney. Dopo le 11.
Pronto, Lionel.
Ciao, Daniel. Where are you? Are you in the Dolomites?
Buongiorno. Yes, I'm on the Dolomites. I'm under the Tre Cime di Lavaredo, which are a huge disappointment because when you come here, you can only see one sometimes, at best two, which is a very unusual, I don't know, it's a strange trompe-l'oeil, as they say in the art world. But
Do you get some kind of badge or sticker if you can see all three? Complete the set. Is that how it works?
I don't know. Like one of those, what are those guys called? The Sangle de Mont Ventoux. If you do all three sides of Mont Ventoux in a day, you get a special badge or something, or a rosette or something, don't you?
Indeed.
Lionel, I've got a surprise for you. Say hello to someone.
Lionel, Ciro here from the top of Cime di Lavaredo. Ciao, my friend.
Ciro, you sound out of your comfort zone there. Too high.
No. My comfort zone, my friend, is very far from here, I can assure you.
Are you well?
No.
Are you okay?
Not bad. And you? Yes. The stage number 22 on Monday is becoming closer and closer, so I'm really good.
What do you do on Monday, Ciro? Do you have some time off, or do you still have stories to write on Monday after the Giro?
Yes, unfortunately, my holidays, for the real holidays, I have to wait the 8th of June. So, I mean, a 4 week and a half, in a certain way. I will try to survive as Jonathan Milan has to survive today. It's the same thing.
He's just been deep in conversation with Vincenzo Nibali, who's up here, of course, the last winner up here. I think we'd both like to know what was being discussed. We've also seen the peacock of San Diego, Filippo Pozzato. He's been competing in the E-Giro, the electric Giro today. We've just seen him struggling up this hill, motor-powered, in a green project. He's competing for Green Project. They have a team in the E-Giro. A very incongruous sight. I've never seen him with that many logos, certainly not on the bike, on his attire. I've seen him with a few sort of Dolce & Gabbana logos sprayed all over his casual wear, but not Green Project. Extremely well, that was Pozzato out of context. So maybe ask Ciro what he was talking about with Nibali.
Yeah. Yes, and there are obviously some secrets between me and my shadow for 15 years, but we spoke also a little bit about the 10 years ago finish here, and the strange thing is that I didn't remember more or less anything about his stage win. The fact is that also Vincenzo Nibali didn't remember anything. Imagine that I ask him, Vincenzo, do you remember, for example, when was the press conference? No. And he told me that I thought that this climb, I had the impression that now is longer than 10 years ago, so completely out of his mind in a certain way, in a clear shark style.
Amazing.
Ciro scuffled off, as he always does, scuffled off down the hill.
I was going to say,
Miserina, where the press room is 8 kilometers away.
Other winners here, Daniel. Ricardo Rico, yes. 2007, I think. Is
of
that
course.
Right? Yeah. I remember that in the distance.
Yeah, we saw his name painted on the road. Don't know if that was someone being ironic. That was the last time. Well, I was up here that day. That was the last time I was up here, in fact. But the crowds line were sensational, especially Slovenians on the climb.
Interesting.
We're obviously pretty close to the Slovenian border, much closer to the Slovenian border than we are to Wales. So that would explain why Geraint Thomas was very much outnumbered, and João Almeida, of course, as well.
Portugal,
in
indeed.
Of the tifosi.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, for all my joking about the Dolomites and my confusion about where they are and what constitutes a Dolomite, it is the sort of symbol of the Giro d'Italia, isn't it? The rock is instantly recognisable. I can remember as a teenager opening a book by Graham Watson called The Visions of Cycling, and there was a stunning photograph of Val Gardena. And that is just burned in my mind, really.
Charlie Wegelius said exactly the same thing to me yesterday. The EF Education Easy Post Direct Sportive, unprompted. He was standing contemplating the Monte Pelmo, which we talked about in yesterday's podcast. And he said, you know, I had a book when I was younger, a Graham Watson book, and that was the picture on the cover.
Yeah, there's something about the Dolomites and those early sort of, you know, adventures in print, really, discovering the Giro. I actually spoke to Graham a bit about this during our Giro a few years ago, which people can look up. If they want to find any of our back catalogue, go to thecyclingpodcast.com, and there is a playlist of every single episode we've ever released on there.
Just quickly on the Dolomites, Brian and I were having a conversation in the car today about how it's sort of consistently disappointed me in the last few years that there's been a larger helping of Alps, i.e. the sort of western sort of Alps, up towards Bad Donecchia and bordering France, than the Dolomites. And you know, these are the iconic mountains of the Giro d'Italia, and I feel that we should, the main chunk of mountains in every Giro, 3 or 4 days, should be in the Dolomites, not just one day or one and a half. We've had two really this year, but I really feel that we should be spending 3 or 4 days here in every year's edition.
I'm with you on that. One other bit of news that you might not know already, Daniel: Theo Gegenhardt tweeted a photograph this morning, or was it on Instagram? I can't remember which social media platform it was, but he's got his hands on a Fossombroni shirt, the iconic.
I asked him
Yeah. Ah. The iconic jersey. I asked him whether he could explain how that came about, and I was hoping he would send us a voice message that we could include in the podcast, but he replied with one word, magic.
Well, at least you've got a reply. I haven't had a reply yet. There we are. That's well, I haven't checked, to be fair, for the last half an hour. Maybe he's replied to say magic to me as well. But very nice looking football shirt. I think cycling jersey design could take some inspiration from the Fossombroni jersey, I think. Sort of concentric circles, isn't it? Slightly off-centre for those trying to describe it in audio for people who haven't seen it. But Theo Gegenhardt's Instagram is where you'll find a picture of that jersey, which, well, it was the star of the opening week of the Giro, wasn't it? Because it was that was almost more interesting than some of the racing early on in the Giro. But here we are with, what, an hour or so's racing left to go this afternoon, and it is hotting up, Daniel. So I better let you go and keep your eyes on the race.
Speak tomorrow, Lionel. Ciao, ciao.
Ciao.
Hi, Brian. That was Lionel, Ciro and me up on the top of the Tre Cime di Lavaredo climb. And that was before the action that unfolded in the general classification group. It was a day of real attrition, wasn't it? It's been a Giro of real attrition. Just, you know, I think it took watching the stage in full to fully appreciate how difficult today, how brutal, how savage today was. Sepp Kuss was asked at the finish, Brian. We won't hear from him today. He was asked why Jumbo-Visma didn't try anything earlier. And, you know, when you saw the riders on the Passo Giao and you think about all the climbing they've done this Giro d'Italia, all the bad weather they've faced as well. And I'd also driven up the final climb up to the Tre Cime di Lavaredo. It wouldn't have crossed my mind, I must say, if I'd been in the Jumbo-Visma team car and in any other team car, to risk my general classification leader.
I can answer that on his behalf as well. Why didn't they attack? Why didn't they do anything? Because they want to win the bike race. They want to have the pink jersey in Rome. You know, it's not professional wrestling. They're actually here to make a result. And something I thought was quite... illustrates how hard this stage was when Geraint Thomas said that, I went at 400 meters to the line. That was probably a little bit too early. I think that's a massive testimony to how hard those last kilometers were. You could win or lose the Giro in the last 500 meters of this stage. That is a very, very significant statement.
But Brian, what conclusions, thinking ahead to tomorrow, and we're going to hear from, the respective riders, direct sportifs in a minute, Roglic's and Geraint Thomas's. What conclusions did you draw from that final climb in particular, and what we're likely to see tomorrow? And who has the advantage besides the 26 seconds, is it now? That's 26 seconds that separates two riders on general classification.
It's quite rare that you look forward to...
A time trial.
Yeah, time trial. But the nature of tomorrow, we'll look at it in detail in the last part of the podcast, but... imagine that either Roglic or Geraint Thomas had won with, say, 45 seconds, and there would have been a significant gap in the GC. We would have thought, then a lot happened on the stage, and the Giro winner probably came out on top of Tre Cime di Lavaredo. But the situation now is it's going to be probably one of the most intense thrillers for the overall winner of this Giro that you can imagine. So I'm very happy that it's close, you know. Yeah, obviously it would have been fantastic if something had happened on the Giro and that they challenged each other more. But I think they found out, and they found out already yesterday, that they are so close and they are probably almost, at the same level physically. So everything will be down to that time trial tomorrow. And I think that's a blessing, because it could have also been not a dull affair. It's going to be quite spectacular because of the difficulties of the climb tomorrow. But now it actually means that we have completely open race, at least for the win of the overall Giro, potentially also with three riders, but definitely two riders with Roglic and Geraint Thomas, all to be either won or lost tomorrow.
Brian, we talked quite a bit yesterday, and I think as well the day before, about this idea of certain riders, certain climbers being suited to certain types of climb, and this preconception that Primoz Roglic likes steeper climbs, which I think is true, but... there's also been the suggestion that Geraint Thomas does not like slopes like the ones we saw today. And he disproved that, didn't
he? Totally,
He did.
I think he surprised a lot of people today as well, especially when he did his attack.
that, I mean, he was trying to do what Roglic usually does to others. I mean, Roglic did come back on him and took those 3 seconds, but nothing that would sort of, I mean, it would have been more significant, it would have been more dangerous if Cort hadn't taken those bonus seconds for finishing third. I mean, I think it's looking really good for Geraint Thomas, but no one can tell at this point anyways who's the favourite for tomorrow. I certainly can't.
It might be a matter of personal preference, judgment, but I always attach a lot of importance to sprints at the end of even mountain stages. I always think that if someone, you know, beats a rival in a sprint, often it's just because of their natural characteristics, they're faster riders, but it does generally signify that they have got energy to spare. And I just think that the momentum is shifting slightly towards Roglic. Whether he runs out of road, and he may well run out of road in this Giro d'Italia, maybe if the Giro was 2 days longer, then we'd see a continuation of this trend and he would overcome Geraint Thomas. But
so here's why I disagree with that.
Go on.
Had Geraint Thomas not attacked and at first dropped Roglic, I would agree with you. I'm not sure there's that much of it. I mean, it's a definite advantage for Geraint Thomas that he finishes, that he starts as the last rider tomorrow in the pink jersey. He will have all the references and all of that. But because Thomas was actually able to put in, he got in a good sort of swing, a punch that shocked Roglic. Roglic came back, but I think that it's a little bit even now in that sense. I don't think that the final little edging him out with a couple of seconds does that big of a difference if you want to stick to that theory about who's potentially stronger tomorrow. I don't think we've seen enough to really have a clear opinion about that.
Brian, should we hear from a couple of people who know much more about this than us pair of knuckleheads? Let's hear, shall we, from the two respective teams, two respective direct sportifs. We'll hear from Mark Rafe, the Jumbo-Visma direct sportif, and then Matteo Tozzato, the Ineos Grenadiers direct sportif, about today and tomorrow.
Well, Mark, what's the verdict? What's the hot take on that? I mean, a couple of seconds back, are you satisfied?
Yeah, you always aim for more, of course, because, yeah, we were this morning still 29 seconds back. We also saw in the end the situation was a bit unclear, but when we saw Kurt Nielsen still riding there with 600 meters to go, we knew, okay, the third place is still possible, plus what means then the 4 bony seconds. But yeah, then also Thomas attacked, and we, the TV was not working at that moment, and we were also too far back to be able to see that. But yeah, I mean, when the TV was working again, we saw that Primoz was a bit behind. And we also know that he always has that final kick again. Yeah. How dead he is, he can always do a really good last few hundred meters. Mm. And with that, he was able to pass Thomas, finishing 3 seconds ahead. And too bad that he didn't became third. But yeah, I think that that also the mental part, for sure, with place three, with the 3 seconds, is really nice. Thomas also went all out, and in the end, Primoz beated him. And I think, tomorrow it's just a race from one to one. There you don't have a guy in front of you who you can follow. Primoz is also all the time already. Yesterday he was trying to do it on the steep part, while Thomas only had to follow. And here again, and yes, Thomas also attacked. But I think that that part will tomorrow play an important role. And I think that especially on the steep parts, Primoz showed that that he's there. And
would you, if you had seen the TV, it had been working, could you have told him to do anything differently in that last sort of 500 meters to maybe make sure he got the seconds?
No, because also Kurt Nielsen is riding for it. He also rode the whole day for it, and you also saw that he still had something left to sprint. I mean, I think from the car they also told him that that they were coming. So I don't think it was just all out. I mean, also Thomas went all out. He went all out, and this is what he had left. So you also have to accept that then, and just be happy with the 3 seconds that he took back.
Tell me about the bike change. So he changed to a single chainring bike. Is that right? And that was specifically for the steep final climb, I guess.
We had it ready. I mean, we never knew if the situation would be able to do the change. But yeah. He also trained with it quite a few times on the training camp the last month, and we had the idea he had the idea already, but we had the idea to do the change. And yeah, what I say, the moment was there in Cortina d'Ampezzo. We did it, and luckily it worked out.
Okay. Will he use the same bike tomorrow on the climb, more or less?
That's possible. We still have to figure that out. It's at moments quite some steep and also longer, so we have to see what we're going to do there.
Last thing on tomorrow, Mark. I remember Planche de Belfi afterwards, Primoz admitted that he'd probably gone too hard on the recon, whereas Pogacar didn't do any recon. Have you got any plans already in place for the first part of the day tomorrow?
No, not yet. To be honest, I'm not sure yet if there will be a recon or how what the timing will be of that. And I mean, for sure, he's not going to ride uphill. It's also a different climb than the Planche de Belfi. Different percentages. It also costs quite some time. You cannot go over it. You have to go back. I also don't know how the organization wants to do it. I think the start of the first rider is already quite early. We go in blocks, so we go get all that information later on this evening, and then we need to make a plan. We were there already. He was there also already.
Viking, I believe.
Yeah. But yeah, you could see what it is. And in the end, yeah, you just have to push the power, and you have to fight against yourself. And if, yeah, he's really a guy who's able to do that. So yeah, that we're just going to focus on ourselves. We do the best possible TT, and in the end, we have to see if that's enough.
Well, Matteo, seeing how Geraint rode on the very steep last climb today, does that give you a lot of confidence for tomorrow?
Yeah, I'm super happy for the performance, the team. Amazing performance. I think, okay, lost 3 seconds, but it's super close to Roglic. Attack Roglic, following immediately after the attack. And amazing for G, because in the steep part for G, you know, it's not the best for him, but in the end, they defended very well. And now it's important to stay calm and focus for tomorrow.
Just talk to me about the effort tomorrow and whether there is any strategy involved, or is it just all-out effort from start to finish?
I think the more important for tomorrow, from my opinion, the another DS, especially with the coach, it's important the first part, no? The first 10Ks in the flat. Be careful, because not going the limit, because after they change the bike, it's super hard. And it's similar today. I think it's more hard. And they imported the pace, not going in the red immediately, but in the same time go all, because now for G and Roglic only 26 seconds is the best to ride now at the moment with Almeida, because Almeida is super strong, but it's difficult because it's super steep. It's important they stay very focused, case by case, meter for meters. I think that it's easy for the riders, because it's super focused, it's a one TT. For us, it's possibly more difficult, because now look at high speed, it put the more energy, is a danger. But now I think it's important, good feedback tonight with the G, also tomorrow after the recon. And
after. Do a recon? You think you'll do a recon?
Yes, but I think in the car. Yeah. I think it's important to go the recon in the car, yeah. I look at the climb, but I think with the G tomorrow is important.
And tomorrow is going to be horrible for you. It's going to be one of the hardest days of your life, I guess.
Yeah, it's horrible, but also it's nice, because my first experience going the moto is behind the race. Now I think tomorrow is a very big day for the Giro, for all riders, especially for the guys stay the place for the win of the Giro, Roglic, Almeida, and G. And I know it's very important waiting, recover very well, because I arrive very late tonight in the hotel. Tomorrow is a very long day. But G is the best for the stay calm. I think it's in good place.
Brian, particularly the conversation with Mark Reef, I suppose when I asked him about how Primoz Roglic is going to spend tomorrow morning, I was touching on, or at least in my own mind, I had images, and I'll never forget standing at the side of the road at the Planche de Belfi on the morning of that time trial and seeing Primoz Roglic go past on his recon and seeing how hard he was going, and thinking again, it was just me being a knucklehead, not knowing anything about cycling, But it did. It worried me. It worried me. And then, sure enough, in a documentary, whether it was a year or several months later, he admitted that he felt the same thing. In hindsight, but just the mental aspect of tomorrow—that's where my weather vane swings back towards Geraint Thomas, because
redemption.
Well, redemption. I just think he's someone who's who will be unfazed by the occasion, and I don't know if that's the case with Primoz Roglic. One other thing. I shouldn't forget, I mentioned at the start of the Giro, these are two riders who have had a lot of misfortune, been sort of bedeviled by misfortune for several years of their careers. They've certainly had bad luck in Grand Tours, particularly one of them tomorrow night is probably going to end up feeling as though they're on the wrong end of some misfortune or a cruel turn of fate yet again.
Yeah. And I think... You know, Roglic obviously has that maledizione, the curse of Planche des Belles-Filles, but don't forget that also Geraint Thomas has had his share of bad luck in the Giro. The Giro that Tao Geoghegan won, Tao Geoghegan was actually supposed to be Geraint Thomas's helper, but Geraint Thomas crashed on the stage to Etna very early on, and he was probably just as prepared for that Giro as he was for this one, and that's already quite a long while ago. And age, you can't take away that Geraint Thomas is closing in on the last seasons of his career, so it's kind of now or never. So someone will definitely feel very unfulfilled tomorrow, slightly, potentially even heartbroken.
Ryan, what do you think about this idea of hiking recons? I love this.
that's right, that's so you, isn't it?
I feel like I think you could beat him to it even. The Monte Lussari has somehow entered into a sort of mystical symbiosis with the mountain. And I would like to think that one day, very soon, we'll see any time of year, you will see general classification contenders for major tours yomping up these passes in Italy, Spain, and France, because Primoz Roglic has set this fantastic precedent that hiking recons are much better than cycling recons.
If he wins. Well, he's certainly not going to hike tomorrow. He hiked in his preparation, as we heard in the interview. But yeah, and interesting also with the two different approaches, what Tosato said and what Roglic just said. They definitely want to do it in the car tomorrow, and Jumbo-Visma still wants to sort of evaluate what the timings, etc. look tomorrow.
I'm not sure they'll be able to get up in the car.
No. You're right. It depends on how early they get up. But
it sounds like the teams aren't fully in the picture about how tomorrow's going to work.
And it's not because of, let me just say that at this point, it's not because Jumbo-Visma is underprepared, but they don't get the exact information for what tomorrow looks like until they get the bulletin for today, which includes everything they need to know, all the start times, all the access to the time trial.
Yeah, there was a lot about it on the communique last night, which I must guiltily admit I didn't read. There was a whole page dedicated to Monte Lussari and the arrangements, but I think from what we heard there from Mark Reef, they're not 100% sure how it's going to work. Brian, we talked about destiny, fate. This morning, I'm sorry to confess, I put the kiss of death on Eddie Dunbar by making a beeline for Jayco Alula and their team manager Brent Copeland, with the goal, the idea of talking to him about Eddie Dunbar and what a fantastic Giro d'Italia he's ridden. He's still ridden a fantastic Giro d'Italia, and he's fifth on general classification. However, he did lose time today. But here is today's Chiacchierata del Giorno, and it is mainly about Eddie Dunbar, and it's with Brent Copeland, the Jayco Alula team manager.
La chiacchierata del giorno. The chin wag of the day.
Well, Brent, I mean, it's been a fantastic Giro for you guys. I imagine it's surpassed even your wildest expectations, hasn't it?
Yes and no. I mean, in theory, on paper, this is what we had planned at the beginning of the year with the performance group. So we had an idea of coming into this Giro, winning one stage and a top 10 with Eddie Dunbar in the GC, but a month ago we were a bit concerned because things were a bit challenging. We were having a difficult time with COVID, injuries, illnesses in the team, so the stars weren't much aligned a month ago. So it's been a fantastic Giro, two stage wins, and Eddie riding so well in the GC, we're very proud of the boys.
Let's talk a bit about Eddie. Who was the one voice in particular in the team that was particularly insistent about signing Eddie, about going after Eddie last year, or was it a sort of consensus?
Yeah, Whitey was definitely one that put his name out there first. It's a rider that he saw and wanted on the team. We were behind that 100% from the start. Spoke to his agent, Gary McQuaid, and yeah, the ideas from the beginning were clear. You know, we were looking for that kind of a rider with those kind of characteristics, and worked out perfectly with Jerry Ryan, our team owner, giving the sign-off on it. So the ideas were clear from the start what we wanted to do with him, but it's been impressive what he's done at this Giro, so makes it clearer for the future what we want to do with him.
I mean, it's well documented that he's had very little Grand Tour experience. Talk to me a bit about the sort of journey he's been on over these 3 weeks in terms of just growing in confidence every day, realising that he is where he belongs.
Yeah, the thing that we've noticed a lot is his maturity. Incredibly mature, knows what he's wanting. But at the same time, he has a calm way about it and doesn't panic at all. And this is a sure sign of maturity, even though it's only second Grand Tour he's ridden. So that impressed me a lot. In 2019, he did his first Giro with his past team. And the thing that we were impressed with there is he came out of the third week really good. So when you come out of the third week of your first Grand Tour, you know that you got the depth and you got the quality. So we knew that, you know, we could try have him ride for GC. We just didn't know if it would work out. And today is still a big day, don't get me wrong. He's still got to get through to today. But as things stand at the moment, he's definitely proved us right. He's done a fantastic job. But very mature, very clear on what he's wanting, and speaks his mind, speaks very well to his teammates, and a great leader.
I was going to ask you about that. You say he speaks very well to his teammates because, again, not having much experience, he wasn't often in a position where he could or was called on to do that at Sky Ineos. So, but that's something that comes naturally to him. He's a good communicator and a leader as well.
Brilliant, brilliant. I must be honest. You know, I've been around a lot of leaders before, and to see him doing his debriefs and talking in the meetings, you would never say it's his second GC, second Giro, second Grand Tour, and riding his GC for the first time. You'd never say it. He really speaks clearly, gets the message across to his teammates in a perfect manner. So, yeah, you know, I think that's also because we showed that we believed in him. We made it clear from the start when we signed him up what we wanted, what we expected of him, and what possibilities we'd give him. And when you give him that trust, you know, he pays it back in an incredible way. And the teammates appreciate that as well, because very respectful person, humble, and great to get on with.
Do you know much about his program for the rest of the year? Will there be a second Grand Tour?
There will be a second Grand Tour. It's still up in discussion with the performance group, but there will be.
He could be a tired boy at the end of July.
Yeah, but you know, he crashed in Valenciana and broke his wrist. So when those things happen at the time, and I was talking to him about this the other day, you often think, my season, it started badly, new team, look at where I am, I got a broken wrist. And he didn't have an easy break. You know, it fractured, and then a week later he had to have an operation because they weren't sure how the fracture was. So it took 2 weeks longer than the medical staff expected, which now you can say is a blessing in disguise, because he came into the Giro a little fresher than he would have if he had done his normal race program. So yeah, those things happen, and you just got to look at the glass half full and look to the rest of the season. And he will be tired, but he did have those 2 months of a lot of indoor training, which is sometimes worse than training normally, but he'll be good.
Just last thing, Brent, another one of your stars on this Giro, he hasn't won, but Alessandro De Marchi, he's been very well gracious towards you as well. He's mentioned you in a number of interviews that you believed in him when other people didn't. I mean, how satisfying has the Giro that he's ridden been?
Yeah, very satisfying. You know, we were criticised quite a lot about bringing on some older riders. We got a lot of young riders, but we brought on some old ones. We were criticised for that. I understand it. It's perfectly understandable. But at the same time, you need those kind of riders with that kind of character that fits into the culture of the team, that's able to get the message across to the younger riders of how racing works, what happens in the peloton, how to look after yourself. And he's incredibly good at transmitting that message to the younger riders. So look what he does in the breaks that he gets into, the work that he does. It's huge for us. It's a really important part, a big asset for the team, and we're very pleased with the job that he's done.
Good morning to everybody. I'm Valentina Zoldan. I work at the Associazione Pro Loco Longarone. Sì. La diga ha fatto da trampolino.
Sì.
E ha acquistato sempre più potenza anche vista la conformazione della gola, essendo stretta. Veramente in quell'occasione hanno vissuto veramente la solidarietà proprio ai massimi livelli.
Sì.
Well, Brian, that was a little audio vignette from the start of our day in Longarone. We spent half an hour or so in the Museo del Vaillant, the museum dedicated to the Vaillant Dam disaster that John Foote described for us or talked about for us in last night's podcast. And it was very touching, wasn't it? Touching, poignant, sad, tragic.
I was not prepared for the impact it would have on me. And I'd listened to the John Foote interview because you sent it to me in preparation for the Giro. But when we stood there in front of the dam and then went to see all the, you know, everything that in the museum, all the photos and all the children's drawings and all that, I couldn't help it. I had to have a moment. It was very, very touching. And I think also because of this year where we've seen all the floodings in Reggio Emilia, and we've seen how much nature can really do if we don't respect it. Because this was, I mean, the Longarone, as John Foote, so he explains quite vividly how there was someone responsible for that.
Well, Brian, I mean, it was prominent in the messaging of the Giro d'Italia today that it's 50 years, and that was why the Giro d'Italia went back. But on the other hand, the sponsor of the pink jersey,
exactly,
is Enel, the energy company.
It's a conglomerate that used to be the company that was responsible for the dam.
Yeah, who's very much sort of on, very much one of the accused in the debacle that was the Vaillant Dam disaster. And, you know, what struck me as well, Brian, maybe as journalists, I was particularly drawn to the board in the exhibition which showed how the disaster was reported, and the delta in the estimates, I guess they were the headlines from the next day. There was Bild Zeitung in Germany that said, oh, 500 may be dead. And there was the Resto del Carlino newspaper in the center of Italy saying up to 4,000 dead. And the actual figure was around about 2,000.
And out of those 2,500 were children or, early teenagers. And when you think of it, imagine just if when one child dies or a family member dies, how many people it actually touches. When you think of it being in the thousands, how many, you know, generations are touched by this even today.
Brian, we were in Longarone already last night, and well, that brings us to our last regular feature of the podcast. As every night, it's time for La Cena di Ieri and La Tappa di Domani.
La Tappa di Domani e La Cena di Ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
So Brian, we were in Longarone last night, and even just being in the community in Longarone, and also you pointed out the architecture, because obviously the place was, well, it was completely rebuilt. It was completely flattened. So, we're in a part of Italy where there is a very distinctive style of architecture, and a lot of the villages look very similar. And then you've got this one town, which is radically, radically different. And I just found myself over the few hours that we were there, just, you know, looking at people and listening to their conversations and finding myself just wondering about how the Vaillant disaster had affected their forefathers, which inevitably it had. I mean, people in the mountains in Italy don't tend to move around that much. There'll be a lot of families still living there who were living there in the 60s. And, we had as for the food, we had hearty mountain fare in Longarone, as you would expect in a mountain village.
Yeah, we certainly did. It was comfort food with the capital C. It really was. Kept us nice and warm.
set us up for
polenta and cheese. What was the cheese called? Stizza, was it?
Yeah, it had like it wasn't called stis.
Stis.
Yeah,
maybe
reminded me of spritz. Anyway, it was a dialect, in the local dialect.
Yeah,
and they were busy too at that restaurant, eh?
Yes, it was a big event for Longarone, wasn't it? The Giro d'Italia coming to town. But tomorrow, Brian, is going to be an even bigger event. And before you start on tomorrow's stage and tell us about tomorrow's stage, I'm going to start by saying that the time trial begins in Tarvisio. And as I wrote on Twitter today, this is a very good omen for Primoz Roglic because he has been a winner in Tarvisio. It was in the 2007 Junior Ski Jumping World Championships where he won the normal hill team event. And it was his last victory in FIS, that's the international governing body of ski jumping. It was his last victory in an FIS event. But Brian, he won't be ski jumping tomorrow.
No, not unless he was going downhill on the last climb.
He'll be cycling.
So, stage 20 of the Giro d'Italia starts in Tarvisio, as you said, and it finishes on top of the Monte Lucari. It's sort of a time trial in two parts, and that also is underlined by the fact that all the riders, at least the ones who are fighting for the GC or the stage win, will be changing bikes at the foot of the first of three time checks it will be. We've seen mountain time trials before in the Giro, and they always try and outdo themselves. You know, I remember one up to the gravel climb up to what was it called?
Plan de Coronas.
Exactly, to Plan de Coronas, where they were going through gravel and they had DSS mechanics on motorbikes.
It's quite similar to that.
It is. It's, I mean, let me just put it this way. The first part is pretty stock standard time trialing, and aerodynamics will play a big part. However, the 7.3 kilometers up to Monte Lucari are ridiculously steep. You can probably compare it to the Sonculan.
Yeah, Matteo Tozzato, the Ineos Grenadiers director of Sportif, I spoke to him about this the other day, and he compared it to the Bola del Mundo, which is the climb above Madrid if you do the Puerta de Navacerrada.
Which is sort of made out of
concrete road, yeah. And we expect tomorrow to be pretty similar. Brian, just tell us about the gradient in that hardest portion.
Double digits all the way. So basically,
average of 15.
Average of 12.1 in total, but the steepest part, which is basically just the wall, it's like five times the Mur de Huy stacked on top of each other. It's double digits all the way, 13, 18, 14, 17, 14, 17. And then actually, even if it evens out a little bit and there's almost like a false flat in the last 3 kilometers, there's a final, when it's 1 kilometer to go, there's a 22% ramp just to make sure that they have nothing left, and then it's just a tiny little downhill and a small uphill to the finish line.
Yeah, there's 4 kilometers there, 15.3%
average. Not even the Mortirolo difficulty.
No, certainly not. Pretty extraordinary stuff. In road stages, when we get climbs that steep, we often say that it sort of neutralizes things in a certain way. The time distances, the time gaps are never that big.
The beauty of that is, Daniel, that the GC is so close, it could be a thriller for the overall win of the Giro all the way to the line.
Brian, is Almeida out of it?
No.
59 seconds down.
No. I mean, sort of analytically, theoretically, mathematically, he's not in as good a position as he was because he lost that time. But then again, who has recovered best after today? We don't know. Who has timed their... Who will time their first part of the stage tomorrow and the last part? Who will have that extra edge on the others? Because if you have a tough kilometer in those conditions and those steep ramps, a minute would sound like a lot in a time trial, but not in that type of climb at the end. He's not in as good a position as the two others, obviously, but he's not. I don't think he's out of it.
Another question, which will maybe answer...
Not out of it for the second place, at least.
Another question, which will maybe answer tomorrow night, is if the time gap is, at the end of tomorrow, a matter of 3 or 4 seconds, will they race on Sunday in Rome? That will be an interesting question as well.
My guess would be absolutely. Absolutely they will.
Well, that's tomorrow, Brian. A lot could still happen, certainly on German classification. We mentioned the riders who could move up a place. Thibaut Pinot, who could leapfrog Eddie Dunbar, get into the top five in what is going to be Is last Giro d'Italia pretty definitive? We had a discussion last night about, well, we both think they should do another year. I had a long chat this morning at the start with his mum, Marie-Jeanne.
The mother of all Alpinos.
Yeah, she is absolutely adamant that another year would not be a good idea. He's got an awful lot to do to occupy him in his life. She thinks that he had it all too young, too soon. That first Tour de France he did when he won the stage. She told me a story today about them having dinner in those awful restaurants, Courte Paille.
Oh, yeah.
They're not that bad. They're sort of motorway, roadside steakhouses in France. You see them all over the place. Not quite as often. They're not quite as common as Buffalo Grills, but almost. And he was sort of mobbed, and they were having dinner one night shortly after that first Tour de France where he won the stage. And he was mobbed, and she said that was the moment where she realized how pressurized his life was going to be for the next few years, and sure enough it's been that. So she's pretty sure that Thibaut is not going to have a change of heart. He's got a lot on his mind at the moment because he's got a cow who should be giving birth at any point, but is 28 days or 24 days overdue at the moment, and this is the reason that Thibaut's father Régis is not or has not been able to come to the Giro d'Italia so far. He was supposed to come yesterday, but he's back home, possibly, as we speak, delivering a foal. Foal?
Calf?
A calf. What am I talking about? I mean, that's embarrassing. The Dane. The Dane, whose command, of English is far superior to mine.
I've recovered better than you have.
Brian, that is it for tonight. We'll be back tomorrow. From Monte Lussari. Is it Monte Lussari or Monte Lussari? I'm going with Lussari because Alessandro Marchi, who is from that neck of the woods, said Lussari to me in an interview earlier in the Giro, but it could be Lussari. I've heard a few Italians pronounce it in different ways. We'll have a definitive answer tomorrow. Until then, bye.
Buonasera, buonanotte.
Buonanotte.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.